Holly Hudson, London.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Yeah, thanks very much, Holly. We will talk about British Steel, of course, in a few minutes' time. How you doing? Are you well? Are you warm? Bloody warm today again. Welcome to the Richie Allen Show. It's good to be back with you. Thanks for your patience. Normal service has been resumed.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show. It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Yeah, it's great to be back with you. You have no idea. It's great to be back. Hope you're well and you're in fine fettle. That's you and yours. Might have to make the occasional adjustment as we go along, as we're in a brand new studio. I'll tell you more about that a bit later on. And if not later on, I'll tell you a bit more about it tomorrow. Delighted to be back. This is your Richie Allen Show, broadcasting right now on Fab Radio 2 in Manchester and richieallen.co.uk. Tune in radio as well. And I think we're on trigger warning. I'm not sure if I gave enough of a heads up to the guys over there. Anyway, let's dispense with the theme song. I'm proper chuffed to be back. I didn't miss much, did I really? I didn't miss much in terms of time, anyway. I missed last week. I said I was taking the week on account of the move. And I said last week, well, I hope to be back by the middle of this week. And I've made it. I am back. And we are in the middle of this week. So there you go. I got something right for a change. Now, you can tweet the programme as usual. The Twitter handle is at Richie Allen Show. That's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. And I'll be happy to read out your comments as we go along. I want to say hi to Coca Bell, my musician friend. We've been Twitter buddies for a number of years now. Very talented woman she is. And she wanted me to get Robin Tilbrook of the English Democrats Party on the programme. And I tried to get Robin on in the past and I failed. And I think that's down to me being not understanding that the likes of the English Democrats Party and other more marginal parties, they don't have the logistical capacity that the big parties have. In other words, they don't have many people working for them. I know the feeling. So when I never heard back from them, I should have chased it up a bit more. You know, again, thinking that, well, they won't have loads of secretaries and undersecretaries, Richie. Anyway, today, Coca Bell said, you got to get this man on. And I tried again, and he spoke with me. And I recorded that conversation a short time ago. So Robin Tilbrook, the founder and chairman of the Brexit supporting English Democrats Party, you'll hear from him and on very soon. And we spoke about a fascinating thing that you might be aware of. He is behind a legal challenge to prove that we've already left the European Union and that we did so on March 29th. Regardless of any deal to extend Article 50 until October 31st, and Robin, why have I got Andrew on the brain? Robin Tilbrook, God forgive me. Robin Tilbrook, the top man in the English Democrats Party, which is a nationalist party, he believes that it doesn't matter what May has agreed with the European Union. We have already left legally. We're gone. And my pal Coca Bell has been banging on about this on Twitter for some time. And I finally got to speak with Robin Tilbrook, and you'll hear that conversation shortly. Loads of tweets coming in to welcome us back. Thanks. Thanks. Armitage Shanks. Good to be back. It really is. Shall we have a chat then? Now, this programme was due to be an hour long. Might be a bit longer. And tomorrow's will be about an hour as well. And then next week, next Tuesday, because Monday's the bank holiday. I don't care. I'm having the bank holiday. I love the bank holidays. So I'll be with you today, tomorrow. I'll be with you on Sunday for Sunday View. And next Tuesday, it reverts to type to a 2-hour current affairs radio show with usually two guests. Right. Good to be back. Did I say that? I might say it again. Right, so it is the 22nd of May, obviously, 2019. And that means it's been 2 years to the day since the Manchester Arena bombing, which killed 22 concert goers. They went to see Ariana Grande. And it's 23 if you count the bomber himself. Now, we were told that Salman Abedi was the bomber, right? We're not certain that we believe that. What we do know, what we believe is 22 people lost their lives that night at a concert. It's a terrible thing. It must have been a terrible thing. Anyway, you know this by now. So today, there were church services, or a church service in Manchester. There were people from all around the place coming into the city to lay flowers. There were interviews with people, including relatives of various victims. Typically, I won't get into it because you've heard me bleat on about it before. It's the pathos thing. It's the media doing its thing. And it's a tragedy to witness. However, there was an interesting interview on Sky with an understandably aggrieved father, a man called Andrew Roussos. Now, you might have seen Andrew Roussos on your television screens over the last couple of years. He's a pretty good speaker. His 8-year-old daughter, Safi, was killed 2 years ago. And I thought it was worth hearing what he said to Sky today, because it is fairly interesting, especially the last bit. So this is Andrew Roussos, whose 8-year-old daughter was killed last year, reflecting on things and talking about how he's doing.
As a father, your duties are to naturally love and protect your children. That's what you're a parent for. And, you know, the job of the emergency services is to look after in cases of an emergency. And that was an emergency. And the frustrating bit is, I get all these people coming up to me saying to me, what can we learn from this? And that's a really wrong thing to say, because terrorism is nothing new. We've had the huge wake-up call of 9/11. Paris the year before was constantly getting attacked. Britain has.
Without distressing yourself too much, just give us a flavour of what living day-to-day without that little girl
torture
is like.
Absolute torture. I can't find words to explain it. You will never understand it. She, as I said, she was larger than life. She was absolutely amazing. She would have gone on to do something spectacular. She captured people within her palms at the age of 8. People stopped her in the street. She would have achieved so much in her life. She was pure innocent young lady that got caught up in this. And it's not fair.
What about Salman Abedi? This was one man, a bomber, goes in, kills your daughter, many other people, maims dozens more. Is he not responsible for this?
Right, we're getting somewhere now. This is getting interesting. Not for a minute am I insensitive to the man saying it's torture to live without his daughter. I'm not insensitive to that at all, but that's a given, isn't it? Isn't it a given? Right, so Salman Abedi then, the man, we were told, and have been told constantly, responsible for the deaths of 22 people, including Andrew's daughter. This is getting interesting.
Responsible for this?
Well, obviously we were told he's responsible. Anyway.
I get this question asked quite a lot. How do you feel towards... He murdered my daughter. How do you want me to... What do you want me to say? He's a murderer, he's a criminal, as many others. You know, if you've lost a loved one through, you know, a terrorist or somebody shooting each other, you know, he's a murderer. So, I can't, you know, what more do you want me to say?
Yeah, so he's a murderer, he's a terrorist. So he stopped short of saying, yes, I blame Salman Abedi for the attack. So, who does he blame?
I put the blame on MI5 and our government for this.
Why?
Because they knew about him. They knew about him a long time ago and they didn't look into him. And this guy went on YouTube to find out how to create a bomb. He went to Libya and came back after a couple of days. And when he's under the watchful eye of MI5, which is the world's most intelligent services, and their job is to protect the country after so many terrorist attacks. And on top of all that, the movements that he had running up to that attack and going to prison and visiting preachers of Islam and not picking up on all these things, for me, what else do you want from him? Do you want him to give you a call in the morning and tell you what?
And tell you what he's doing. Very interesting, isn't it? He's described excellently there what the mainstream narrative is. Now, this isn't the conspiracy theory narrative. It's the mainstream narrative. They told us that Salman Abedi was well known to the intelligence agencies of this country, of France, of Israel and Germany and Italy and so on. They told us he travelled in Libya, he travelled in Syria, he travelled in Turkey, and that flags were raised everywhere he went. They told us exactly when he came back into the country, into Manchester, which was only a few days before carrying out the attack. Interesting turn of phrase there. What do you want him to do, Salman Abedi? What more do you need him to do to be able to follow him? Do you need him to phone you up in the morning and tell you, all right, guys and gals, this is where I'm going to be today? So this dad is very interesting, and he's getting somewhere with this. You know, he's really getting somewhere. So here we go.
And through all these reports that we've seen so far, you know, there is blame on them.
There is blame on them. So he followed this by saying he needs the inquest to start really quickly. I wouldn't have had the heart to tell him, don't hold your breath in terms of the inquest throwing up the truth. But he's on the right track here. I would direct him to an interview that I did with David Shaler, former MI5 officer, who, of course, many, many years ago blew the whistle on a number of things, including MI6's determination to murder Colonel Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, and how they used a man called Agent Tunworth. That's right, Agent Tunworth. And Agent Tunworth only happened to be Ramadan Abedi, the father of the alleged Manchester bomber, Salman Abedi. This is quite extraordinary. And I wonder, does Andrew Roussos know this? Maybe he does. Because shortly after David Shaler was on this programme, The Guardian was one of only two newspapers to write about the connection between the son and the father who had worked for MI6. He was given a lot of money to oversee an operation to assassinate Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. Look, a lot of people died at the arena 2 years ago, but did Salman Abedi do it? It's very unlikely. Or at least it's unlikely that he did it willingly or even knowingly. Interesting that the father is moving away from talking about the terrorists and looking to put the blame on the intelligence agencies who inexplicably allowed this man enter the country, having been warned about his movements in the Middle East, having been told that he was a very dangerous man, arrives back in Manchester and they can't manage to follow him, to see him take possession of or build a devastating bomb that he then puts in a backpack and that he then explodes in the foyer of the arena. This is why programmes like this exist, to ask these questions. Moinga asks, was the clip taken near running water? Yes, Guy interviewed the man near a fountain there. Right, loads of tweets on this, understandably. And Faisal's tweet is very interesting. Let me read it. He says, Richie, funny I wasn't able to find any smartphone footage of the Ariana Grande performance from that concert or any evidence of promotion or ticket sales, says Faisal. Now, I don't know about ticket sales or promotion, but I do remember there were some YouTube videos of the concert itself going on, because this bombing took place, of course, at the end of the concert, right, as people were leaving. But there were some videos uploaded, because most people, when they go to a concert, sadly, they don't watch the concert and enjoy themselves. Sadly, they don't. They don't. They're incapable of doing that. They've got to now watch the concert through the screen of their smartphone. These morons. This is what they do. We do concerts. We go to a lot of concerts. Caroline and myself And it's a dreadful thing to see people in front of you watching the concert on a screen. But anyway, they record bits of it and they put it on YouTube. It might be the case that because of the nature of the night and what happened, that YouTube, Google, whatever, deleted all footage of the concert. It might be Faisal. Not saying it is, because I also find it interesting that it is difficult to find any footage of the actual performance before, of course, the explosions. That's a good point, mate, and I take it on board. Hi to Dean Smith and to Ian Schilliger. How you doing, Ian? And to Molly Pitcher. How you doing, Molly? And to Money Seeker Records as well. We're going to move on. Hi to Paul Alawi. Paul says, Richie, what could possibly be gleaned from questioning that poor bloke? Anyone with a heart can imagine what it must be like to lose a child, even if they don't have one themselves. It's gutter journalism, says Paul. I'll bet the interviewer had no idea the dad would blame MI5. It's a good point, Paul. MI5, of course, is responsible for domestic security. Right? MI6 deals with threats coming from outside the country. If I've gotten that wrong, I probably have. But there you are. Moinga asks, I wonder if the dad heard the David Shaler interview. I don't know, but I might try and track down Andrew Roussos and respectfully and gently nudge him in the direction of that interview. Hi to Andy Newman as well. So it's the 22nd of May, 2 years since the bombing, and nobody is any the wiser, at least the families of those who died, as to how it happened and who ultimately was really behind it. Now, here's a very serious story. And if you're in the UK today, or Ireland, because Ireland gets Sky News, of course, as well, you'll be aware that British Steel has been placed in compulsory liquidation. A dreadful thing. A dreadful thing. Now, I'm a working class boy. I come from Ballybeg in Waterford City. And I know what it's like when factories close. And when factories get into severe difficulties. It happened to my family and my friend's family. It's a terrible thing. Thousands of jobs are at risk. 5,000 directly at British Steel, the second biggest manufacturer of steel here. And down the line, 20,000 people face losing their jobs. Not funny, this. Right, so the BBC reports this follows a breakdown in rescue talks between the government and Grey Bull. Grey Bull owns the company. Because, of course, British Steel is not owned by the people or isn't nationalised. Of course it isn't. Anyway, the government's official receiver has taken control of the company as part of this liquidation process. And they're going to look for a new buyer for British Steel. Not going to be easy. And in the meantime, of course, it's going to keep trading. But the people working there are going to lose a lot of sleep between now and the appointment of a new buyer or it going out of business. Dreadful thing. British Steel Limited was wound up in the High Court and the immediate priority was to continue safe operation of the site. That's a direct quote from the official receiver. Now, if they failed to find a buyer, well, that's it. It's kaput. Now, who'd buy it? Who would buy it? I'm going to tell you why it's going to be difficult to get a buyer in the current climate. Should be nationalised, of course. Right? All right, but you've heard that old chestnut on the Richie Allen show before. So the BBC and Sky are focusing on one aspect of the difficulties of British Steel. And this is typical of the mainstream media, right? It vomits out this bullshit all day long. They talk about the weakness of the pound since the EU referendum 3 years ago. And they talk about the escalating China-US trade war. All of these things are problematic for the steel industry in the UK. They're proper bastards, Sky and the BBC, because steel has been in trouble for years and years and years in this country on a sliding, going down. It's been in quicksand for years. Why? Why? You know the answer I'm going to give. It's because of the UK's membership of the European Union. It really is. Shall I read you from some learned men and women in the media? In the media. Must make a song for charity. In the media. To the tune of In the Navy by the Village People. In the media. Here's Alan Tovey writing in the Telegraph. Listen to this. The first life-threatening issue for British Steel was the EU carbon emission permits scheme to tackle climate change. Are you listening now? The first life-threatening issue for British Steel was the EU carbon emissions permit scheme to tackle climate change. Under normal conditions, Brussels awards a certain amount of permits for free to heavily polluting industries, such as steelmakers, every year. So every year, the EU has a carbon emissions permit scheme, and that's a constant. And every year, it gives a certain amount of permits for free, to industries that pollute, like steelmakers. However, polluting companies have to pay for each ton of emissions with a permit. If they reduce their emissions and have more permits than they need, they can auction them. Right? You get it? A little bit complicated. It makes sense if you think about it. So the European Union gives a certain amount of permits for free to industries like steel every year. Heavy polluting companies must pay for each ton of emissions with a permit. If they reduce their emissions and have more permits than they need, they can auction them. But that's never the case. So British Steel sold off some of their permits to create working capital, but then found itself squeezed as the European Union halted permit issuance to UK companies until a Brexit deal is finalised. So they were screwed. So I'll read that again. British Steel sold off some permits to create working capital, but then found itself squeezed as the European Union halted permit issuance to UK companies until they do a Brexit deal. Right. Manufacturers can use their normal allocations to pay for their previous year's emissions, but British Steel was cut out in what one called a badly timed bet as permits surged in price once UK allocations were suspended. So as a result, British Steel had to get a £120 million government loan to buy new permits or face a massive cash crunch. Do you understand that? Now, all day long, you would have heard about a £120 million loan given to British Steel. This is it. This is the loan to buy new permits. And questions are being asked today, of course, about why British Steel was given that money when officials must have known how serious the shit that it is in is, right? You get it? Okay. The European Union. So back to the European Union. Here's Jessica Shankelman. This is an article from Bloomberg in April 2016. Have a listen to this. Jessica Shankelman writing in Bloomberg in April 2016. The UK steel crisis, worsened by Tata Steel Limited's decision to sell its plant in Port Talbot, South Wales, has been exacerbated by three green taxes that the government implemented to boost clean energy, according to the Manufacturers Association, EEF. The levies, the three levies, are the carbon price floor, renewables obligation, and feed-in tariff policies. Each works differently. Together, they increase steelmakers' energy costs by about £30 per megawatt hour. This is massive. Electricity is an enormous cost for steel consumers, steel companies. Electricity is an enormous cost for steel companies. So the UK's seven steel plants used about 3.2 million megawatt hours of power in 2014, not including what they generated themselves. Do you get it? £30 per megawatt hour. They use collectively 3.2 million megawatt hours. Three green taxes ordered by the European Union and implemented by the government. Means what, Richie? You're screaming at your bloody radio or your smartphone. Well, it means that massive costs enforced by the European Union make it impossible for British steel manufacturers to be competitive. What does that mean? Well, listen to this from the journalist Simon Blanchard. Now, Simon Blanchard wrote this in February of this year, so 3 months ago. He wrote, "The British Army's new Ajax fighting vehicle is built in Spain using Swedish steel. How wonderful! At the request of the EU Commission to support jobs in Spain rather than in Wales. A decision mostly made because the UK government has to follow EU Defence Procurement Directive." Which directive? Directive 2009/81/EC. meaning contracts for defence have to be tendered across the EU internal market. And this was announced just before the Brexit vote in May 2016. This was announced just before the vote in 2016, but it wasn't mentioned on any television or radio news channel, because this is the shit they don't want you to know. The British steel industry employs tens and tens and tens of thousands of people, with hundreds of thousands more employed further down the manufacturing process. And European Union green laws and carbon taxes and competition laws mean that a new fighting vehicle for the British Army is made in Spain using Swedish steel. Because of an EU Defence Procurement Directive 2009/81/EC. And that's what's destroying steel in this country. That's what destroyed fishing in this country. And that's what's destroyed manufacturing in this country as well. It's a fact. Now, Simon Blanchard, the journalist, continues. With this in mind, three Royal Fleet auxiliary support vessels are up for tender abroad too. The decision whether a UK shipyard gets the contract or it goes abroad is pending, subject to government decision. The prospect looks bleak for UK shipyards the longer we remain in the European Union. Why not freeze the tendering process and award the contract to a UK shipyard after we leave the EU? That's Simon Blanchard, the journalist. None of this is conjecture. I use this term quite a bit. I know. I hear you. You say that quite a lot, Richie. It's not conjecture. It is fact. It's fact. This is why hundreds of thousands of jobs are at risk and the government can't do anything about it because it is prohibited from doing so. And this is going to boil your arse as well. It's not going to boil your blood. It's going to boil your arse. Have a listen to this. EU, or the EU, is also in the habit of dragging companies out of the United Kingdom and into Europe. And I talked about this over the years. This has been going on for years. How does it do that? Well, the European Union encourages UK-based companies, basically, to leave here and go abroad by inducing them to do so with loans. Low-interest loans. Very low-interest loans. And promises that you've got cheaper labour in this country. You're not supposed to know this stuff. Companies that want to expand. The European Union says, don't expand in England. Fuck, excuse my French, the fact that the local workforce has been very good to you and has helped you expand, and you want to expand a bit further, but you don't have the money. Well, screw the workforce that have been loyal to you. Why don't you go and put your company in Spain or Portugal, and we'll give you a big loan. This has been happening for years. This is the European Union. And this is what you don't hear on the mainstream television programmes and radio programmes. They won't tell you this, but it's a fact. Blanchard writes, and this is brilliant. Let me read you what he writes. I know this is a bit long-winded, but bear with me. He writes, the Mini that David Cameron famously stood in front of as an example of British engineering was actually built by BMW in Holland and in Austria. The Battle Bus for Remainers in June of 2016 was made in Germany, even though the UK has Plaxton, Optare, Bluebird, Dennis, etc., companies that could have built it. Cadbury's moved their factory to Poland in 2011, you know that. Ford Southampton moved their transit van plant to Turkey in 2013 because they were given an £80 million loan from the European Union, backed by George Osborne, when Osborne was not only the Chancellor of the Exchequer, but the Governor of the European Investment Bank. Did you know that? You didn't know that, did you? And I know this is heavy now. This is heavy stuff, but you have to know this stuff. Because nobody is telling you this stuff except me. And these journalists who are blocked at every turn when their articles were not picked up and were not syndicated and were not republished in other magazines. This is a fact. Jaguar, owned by Tata Steel, you know that. Up to their necks in it. And Back in October of last year. Back in October of last year, Jaguar Land Rover agreed to build a new plant in Slovakia. Why? Because they were given 125 million euro from the Slovakian government at the behest of the European Union Commission. And all of that can be proved. It's not conjecture. It's all out there. It's all out there in the cybersphere. If you put this stuff in, you'll get articles from Slovakia. You'll get articles from Brussels. You'll get an article from the Telegraph telling you Jaguar Land Rover going to build a plant in Slovakia. 125 million loan from the Slovakian government and the European Union Commission. Mental. So back to the steel then. British Steel. Business Secretary Greg Clark, speaking in Parliament today, told his opposite number, Shadow Business Secretary Rebecca Long-Bailey, I'd love to help, but I can't. Listen to him explain it.
I have been exhaustive in pursuing over many weeks now possibilities with British Steel. She, if she's in government, will find that you're obliged to follow the ministerial codes. You're not allowed to make a decision that would be illegal. Immensely frustrating though it is, I would much preferred to have given the opportunity of this loan rather than go the route that it has. But that is the requirement and there is no possibility of setting that aside.
Unbelievable. That's, I mean, that is unbelievable. That's the business secretary of the UK government saying, I can't do anything about British Steel. We're not allowed. The rules say that we can't bail them out. And that's what it is. And you know, there will be people listening to this saying, ah, Richie, you're very selective in the information you pick because you obviously don't support membership of the European Union and you have always been anti-Brussels. Of course I have. But I've had people on this programme in the past who've been in favour of membership of the European Union as well. What I'm telling you is absolutely true. This is why British Steel, in terms of the company British Steel Limited, but also the other steel companies, are finished. And why nobody would want to buy British Steel now. Why would you want to? You can't compete. You can't get contracts in your own country. What's wrong with that? And I'm not some screaming bloody nationalist. You know that. An old socialist. A real one, not a social democrat or a lefty. I'm a socialist, which tends to nationalism in these issues. The European Union has destroyed these industries deliberately through the imposition of these carbon taxes and these green taxes to make these industries in this country completely uncompetitive. They can't do anything. And then the European Union says, oh, by the way, the government cannot award a project to a British company. I know for some of you this is not new, but for most people they don't have a Scooby-Doo because they don't hear this on the BBC. They don't know. I wonder, do the employees of these companies know this? They must do. Christ! You know, it is a brutal, vicious, fascist dictatorship, the European Union. That is what it is. Designed to destroy individuality, nationalism, national sovereignty right across Europe and beyond. Because it doesn't end with the countries of Europe. Where there is absolutely no power in the hands of the people in any of these countries. Power is concentrated all the time into fewer and fewer and fewer groups of people. So they can get away with doing stuff like this. George Osborne, huh? People don't know this stuff. George Osborne oversaw Ford Southampton going to Turkey. He gave the loan. Where did you hear this on the news back in 2013? You didn't hear it. We talked about it in London at TPV television. We said, but who was watching us, you know? This criminal bastard. Not to mention, I could go into other incidences of corruption when Osborne was the Chancellor. Let's move on. Theresa May is in trouble. Her I mean, I don't know. By the time I go off air, it could be the end of Theresa May tonight. It could be tomorrow. But her time as Prime Minister is coming to an end. This is, of course, because of her attempt to get her withdrawal agreement through the House of Commons again for the fourth time. She published her new brief, her new agreement on Friday last. But there's been a massive backlash against her and it from MPs on both sides of the House of Commons. She's been bribing those who want to stay in the European Union by saying, support my bill and you can then have a vote on whether or not to hold a second referendum. So May's been saying, support my withdrawal agreement, which is not leaving the European Union. I don't think you need me to tell you about that. Theresa May's agreement with Brussels and the amended agreement is not actually leaving the European Union. It is leaving in name only, or Brexit in name only. In fact, it's a worse situation for the country than actually staying in. It's that bad. So she addressed Parliament today. Jeremy Corbyn had his say too. I'm not going to subject you to any of the audio clips. She has pledged to set a timetable for a new leader to take over after MPs vote on her compromise Brexit plan. This all happens in the week beginning June 3rd. However, some MPs are seeking to change party rules in order to get rid of May earlier. They want to oust her at a meeting of backbench MPs. This is all happening later on. So something might happen in the next 24 hours, 36 hours. The BBC's political editor Laura Koenigsberg also called the meeting of Brexiteers the Pizza Club. Members have been meeting today. As I said, May was answering questions in the House of Commons. They were meeting at that time. They were not in the House listening to May. So there you go. Right, right. Shall we move on? Because tomorrow, amazingly, sees the people of the United Kingdom go to vote to place MEPs in Brussels. That's right, 3 years after the United Kingdom left the European Union, or chose to leave the European Union in that famous referendum of June 23rd, 2016. Not only have we not left the European Union at all, but we're going to take part in EU parliamentary elections tomorrow. It's a staggering thing. People should be on the streets with pitchforks and torches, I tell you. But they're not, I tell you. I don't know why they're not, but they're not. So anyway, I caught up with a very interesting gentleman today, a man called Robin Tilbrook, the founder and chairman of the English Democrats Party. Now, they've been around a while, and they're a nationalist party. They're not nasty thugs, these people. They're very interesting people. They're a nationalist party. Don't think the English Defence League, nothing like any of that. These are good people, and they're very bright people. He's an economist, by the way, is Robin Tilbrook. And I invited him on the programme today. My pal Coca Bell was trying to get him on in the past. I mentioned her earlier on. So Robin came on, and I wanted to invite him on because my pal, the aforementioned Coca Bell, is very interested in the coverage, or the lack of coverage thereof, of Robin Tilbrook and his legal challenge to the government. And this is a real challenge, by the way. This is going through the court as we speak. He's basically contending that we've already left the European Union. We left on March 29th, 2019, which is only 8 weeks ago. And that Theresa May's decision to meet with the European Union and to come together to decide that we will delay leaving until October 31st is moot. It doesn't matter. Because without an act of Parliament, it's worthless, according to Robin Tilbrook. He says we've already left, and he's challenging this through the courts, kind of a la Gina Miller. Although he's a million miles away, of course, from Gina Miller. So, Chairman of the English Democrats Party, Robin Tilbrook, was on the Richie Allen Show earlier on. He wasn't on the show, he was with me. We recorded this earlier on. I first of all said to him, isn't it a tad depressing? Are you not frustrated that we're even having these European parliamentary elections tomorrow? This is what he said.
It is frustrating. It's it just shows how far the British political establishment have got from actually doing what our democracy says they ought to do. I mean, they've simply abandoned the basic ideas of democracy, which is obviously if you have a referendum, a result, then that should be implemented. I think a lot of people feel really very cross indeed about this, and they're getting crosser and crosser, which is, of course, why we're expecting a big turnout in the EU elections for the Brexit Party. You know, that sort of captured the zeitgeist at the moment, where people are just feeling absolutely furious and with the establishment parties, and they want to register the point that they want to be out.
Really interesting you mentioned the turnout, because obviously I was going to ask you about that. European Union elections, traditionally, not just here in the UK, but in my country, Ireland, suffer from a fairly low turnout. But you think tomorrow the outrage will be that, or such, that there will be high turnout?
Well, a relatively high turnout for the EU elections, which, as you rightly say, are generally not very high turnout. One of the things I found quite interesting on Facebook and Twitter is that there's been people trolling out there from the Remain side, trying to basically say to Leavers that they shouldn't vote, because it would be somehow acknowledging that the EU had a legitimacy, and basically trying to mess with people's heads in order to try and stop them from voting, which I think just shows how desperate they've become, really.
Yeah, these are crazy times. My listeners, of course, will know my position on the European Union. I've always believed that it's a fascist dictatorship. There should be no such thing. This country and my own country shouldn't be a member of it. So it's not going to make for the most competitive conversation, this, in terms of me challenging you. But look, I will be the devil's advocate as best as I can. I really want to talk about the legal challenge. You've made national headlines in the last few days and in the last weeks with this legal challenge to prove that we've already left. And I want to talk about that in a minute. Before that, though, to be fair to those who demand a second referendum, and there are a lot of people, at least I've heard from a lot of people, who did vote leave, who say that they would like another go because they feel that Brexiteers told a hatful of lies in the campaign before June 2016. Now, is it fair to say that on both sides, and I'm not talking about you, Robin, specifically, but I'm talking about the likes of Johnson and Farage and others, and of course the Remainers, Vince Cable and the others, did everybody tell a pack of lies? And if everybody told a pack of lies, surely it's fair enough to have another referendum, and this time clearly put on the ballot paper, leave with no deal. What do you think?
Well, no, I don't agree about having a second referendum. What we've got here is a situation where we were told it was going to be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to vote for it. The government actually put out a leaflet at public expense telling us how awful it was going to be and what a disaster it would be if we voted to come out. But they finished up by saying that they would implement whatever the result. The reason that the referendum was called in the first place was because the government under Cameron thought that they were going to win it, and they were going to destroy Euroscepticism. That was their objective. The kind of absolute nonsense that was talked about what would happen if people voted leave. We were told that there would immediately be a financial meltdown, that the economy would collapse. You know, there would have to be almost a sort of punishment beating type of budget immediately afterwards. And of course, none of that happened. It was all a pack of lies. It was just one of those things where people thought to themselves that they didn't really believe what politicians had to say. We were right. We were right not to believe them. And of course, we've been shown again to be right not to believe them, because despite having promised on both sides of the House of Commons to honour the result, both parties have been complicit in trying to sabotage it.
Well, before we talk about the legal challenge, and then I want to talk about British Steel, let me remind our listeners, Robin Tilbrook is live on the program. Well, he's not live, we recorded this earlier on. It's really important you hear this. He's the chairman of the English Democrats Party, who have candidates, of course, in the EU parliamentary election tomorrow. Why has it happened, Robin? Why has the political class ignored the will of the people? What's the reason behind it? I don't think too many media outlets have tried to get behind the reasoning. Why have they ignored the people?
Well, the interesting thing that sort of come out of the Brexit result is that we've seen that the political establishment in Westminster, that what they talk about, they don't talk about democracy, they talk about liberal democracy. And it turns out that liberal democracy means that the majority never get their way. And the whole point of the liberal bit is to prevent them from getting their way. And you have all sorts of structures that make it difficult for the majority to ever get their way, which is, of course, why the liberal democratically minded constitutionalists didn't really like the idea of a referendum. But they were sort of persuaded into it by the thought that this was going to destroy Eurosceptics, who they don't like. And contrasted against that is that there are people who are popular Democrats, populist Democrats, I think some of the papers are calling them. That's the idea where you actually do what the majority of the people want done. The sharpest distinction in terms of arguments that have been going on between those two groups. And one of the things that's been really interesting to me is the numbers of the so-called Liberal Democrat people, like Matthew Paris, for example, who wrote in The Spectator, more or less gloating about the fact that when he was a Conservative MP, he deliberately set out to deceive the electorate and to lie to them about what he actually stood for. And he gives an example of the death penalty. He stood on the ticket that he supported the death penalty, but he never did actually support it. And what he said was that whenever this topic came up, he always voted for it in principle, but then voted against every detail to make it impossible to get it through.
Yeah. Yeah,
so we're faced with that kind of mentality from the establishment. They don't want this result. The establishment in Parliament on both sides of the House want to remain in the EU, and they found that they're facing an increasingly hostile population. Who they can now see that these people are basically trying to prevent us from getting what is clearly a democratic decision.
Yeah, amazingly, 3 years since the vote was taken, and here we are on the eve of this election. Robin Tilbrook is our guest. We've got Robin for a few more minutes. I want to talk about the legal challenge. This is fascinating. Robin has made national news headlines in recent days over the last couple of weeks because he believes that legally, and I tell you what, Robin, I've been going over this frontwards, backwards and coming from every side. I think you're right. Legally, we left the European Union on March 27th. We are out. Explain this to our listeners and explain the legal challenge and where you are with this.
Okay, so in the run-up to the
29th of March,
I could see that the government was getting wobbly on whether or not we were going to go out. And so I got prepared the ground. I wrote to them in February. In the English courts, you're required to do a pre-action protocol letter. So I did that, setting out what our view would be. And then when we didn't come out on the 29th and Theresa May asked for more time and then agreed an extension, immediately I was ready to issue proceedings. And those were issued and served on the 2nd of April. We've now had the government's response. We've put in detailed submissions. We're ready for the next phase in the judicial review proceedings, which would be the court deciding how we're going to deal with the trial of it. In the meanwhile, we've talked to a lot of other lawyers both solicitors, barristers and QCs. Virtually nobody has come up with any argument against us as to whether or not we've got a strong argument. except for a couple that are being paid to come up with the alternative view, like the government's most senior barrister, Sir James Eady QC, who was the one that they put up against Gina Miller in the case that's absolutely got wall-to-wall coverage of at about the same sort of stage as we're at the moment, where we're getting very little coverage. But in the Gina Miller case, he was actually tried to claim that that it was unconstitutional for the court to even consider a claim. So he has a bit of a track record of being a bit over the top in what he says. But our case is in principle quite a simple one, in as much as any constitutional case could be. Because what happened here was that we served our notice under Article 50, a two-year notice, and we did that properly in terms of the Constitution, because the Gina Miller case decided that what had to happen was there had to be an Act of Parliament authorising the service of the notice. So there then was an Act of Parliament. It was a very short Act of Parliament. It's 137 words. It really says nothing more than that the Prime Minister has power to serve a notice withdrawing the UK from the EU. That's the end of it. There's no further rights or powers. And the Gina Miller case also made it clear from the highest court of the land, Supreme Court, that ministers only have really two powers, two sources of power. Either it's in statute from the Act of Parliament or as ministers of the Crown. On the royal prerogative, and the royal prerogative is only there where there isn't an act in that area of activity, government activity. So in this case, we've got an act, and that means there's no royal prerogative, and that matters a lot, because what happened was that we got the act, the notice was served, the notice expired. And the government didn't get another Act of Parliament authorising them to ask for further time or to agree further time.
That's right, they didn't. That's really interesting, that, because I know it's probably been thrown at you, and it will be thrown at me, that Lord Kerr, who drafted the legalese or the text of Article 50, has been saying, of course, in recent months and even last year, that the process is reversible and it's also possible to suspend it. Whether or not it's been put to him, whether an Act of Parliament is needed or not, I'm not sure. I haven't seen any such question put to him. But I think you're absolutely right. You're right to mention, too, the coverage of Gina Miller and her campaign, as opposed to the coverage you're getting. I mean, you have been in The Express and one or two other papers, but I've not seen you. I've not heard you on BBC regional radio stations. I've not seen you on the BBC. It is fair to say that you've not had that coverage. How optimistic are you that you can proceed with it, Robin?
We've raised enough money to be certain of being able to proceed with it.
Brilliant.
We haven't got quite enough to be sure that we're going to have a top flight team, but we've got enough to be able to do what we need to do. But so it's a question of you know, just how many sort of bells and whistles we can put on it, rather than whether or not we can actually do the basic job. We can do the basic job. We've got enough money to do that. But just as a for instance, I haven't currently got enough money to instruct a QC to do the actual hearing, but I have got enough money to instruct the barrister we've got at the moment to do it. So I'm pretty confident of being able to bring this case to court. As I say, you know, all the opinions that we've had about it, except for Sir James Eady, of course, were paid by the government, have been positive. And in fact, we had a retired Court of Appeal judge, Sir Richard Aikins, who said that he felt that the case was strongly arguable and that it was arguable that we were out.
You're on solid legal ground there, I think.
I think we're on solid legal ground.
Well, yes. We're obviously going to watch that along with everybody else. I know you were on RT, and kudos to RT for giving you a hearing and The Express. Yes. It's very important. It's really important that. I want to.
You might like today that we've had confirmation from Laura Koonsberg that we have actually been blocked by the BBC.
No way. Yeah. On what grounds? Blocked on what grounds?
I'm afraid it was a reported conversation, so I didn't get the opportunity to ask her that. But I think basically they don't. Their analysis, I would guess, is that that this is a case that genuinely could get us out of the EU.
So
obviously it winds up getting us out on World Trade Organization terms, because there will not be the agreement won't have gone through. Theresa May's agreement won't have gone through. So we are straight away out. And of course that is exactly the result that the BBC most dislikes.
Yeah, the BBC is unashamedly pro European Union, and I do try and be fair with the BBC.
Since the referendum, they've been completely shameless in the way that they've behaved about that.
That's, yeah, any time there's been any... I know you're an expert in economics, I know that from research, and you, Robin, and any time there's been any good news, they've used terminology like, despite Brexit, it's been dreadfully apparent in their language. I want to add, this is really important, this court case, and we're going to keep an eye on this, as everybody else should do. Shameful news about the BBC blocking you and your party. But let me ask you this. I would use today's bad news, which has been building for some time about British Steel, which I've been talking about in the monologue earlier on. I would cite that as a perfect and glaring example of why this country and any other country shouldn't be a member of the European Union, because the country is effectively, the government is hamstrung, as I believe Greg Clark, the business secretary, in fact told his opposite number, Rebecca Long-Bailey. Well, I'd like to do something, but the rules prohibit it. In other words, we can't aid the steel industry in this country, and we can't help protect 5,000 jobs. You would say, of course, Robin, this is what we've been talking about for years.
I would, yes. I mean, as you say, it's a classic example. It's not only we can't subsidise, but actually subsidies are being allowed elsewhere. We're finding it very difficult to maintain any of these type of businesses. There's been a sort of spate of mergers, and it's clearly workers in the UK who are easiest to sack by comparison to most of the continental systems, where there's quite strong controls on who can be sacked and how, and also it's quite expensive to do it. So when there's going to be a round of redundancies, it's more than likely it's going to be here. And the EU simply doesn't look after our interests. One of those things where you wind up with the worst of all possible worlds as far as looking after our industry is concerned.
Is it, just before we leave today, and thanks for coming on, by the way, Robin can be found at englishdemocrats.party. That's englishdemocrats.party. The founder of the party and the chairman, Robin Tilbrook, is speaking with me now about that fascinating and very important a legal challenge that he's behind to prove that we've already left the European Union. This is, of course, ahead of tomorrow's election here in the country, which is shocking and shameful and sad and depressing, but there you are. On the legal challenge, just quickly, before I should have asked you this a second ago, it was on my mind. Have you contacted fellow Brexiteers and asked them to at least champion, talk about the legal challenge? I'm thinking, of course, about Farage and Jacob Rees-Mogg. They should be talking about this legal challenge, have they?
Yes, well, I certainly have contacted both of those, and they were copied in. Nigel Farage obviously wasn't particularly keen on the idea, and I'm afraid that's because he actually wanted to have this this election. Our court case was a threat to whether or not the election was going to go ahead. Having said that, I think having the election may prove to be useful, because actually what's going to happen is that the British establishment parties are going to get an absolutely bloody nose.
Shellacking tomorrow, possibly. Yeah, there's no doubt about that. Well, look,
that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's a good thing. I'll be speaking to, possibly be speaking to a member of the Brexit Party, if not today, tomorrow. So I'll give them a chance to retort in terms of, you know, your claim that they wanted, or at least Farage wanted the election. Let me finish on the Steele issue, because Clark saying my hands are tied, I'd like to do this or that but I can't, is obviously, again, very revealing for people who don't understand the European Union. You do, I do. But isn't it true that other countries seem to be able to flaunt these rules? In Germany, the government is pretty good, I understand, at looking after the interests of its steel industry. So it seems that some countries tend to be forced to follow the rules and others get away with it. I'm thinking of the implementation of these carbon taxes that came in, of course, during the last Labour government. It seems that countries like Germany can play fast and loose with these rules, whereas we have to abide by them. Is that fair to say?
It certainly is, isn't it? It's quite striking how the rules tend to be flexible when many other countries want to do whatever they want to do. But our system just seems to be quite incapable of adopting a similar approach. People have often talked about the idea that the British civil service gold plates these rules. You know, whenever they're given a new rule, rather than looking to do what's most reasonable and effective for business, they're looking instead to build up a sort of little bureaucratic empire of trying to control all of us and keep us all doing whatever it is that the rule says we ought to be doing.
Massive stitch-up.
Whether it's good for us or not.
You know, it's a massive stitch-up. If you and I had more time, we could spend a lot of time talking about why the Prime Minister appointed Ollie Robbins after the last election. You know, this
it was fascinating to see, wasn't it, in that programme about Brexit, that he seems to have applied for a Belgian passport.
Yeah, that's right. that's a good way to leave it. Thanks for your time today. Good luck to you and to your colleagues tomorrow, Robin. I'm sure you'll come back on again and speak to us in the near future about the implications of tomorrow's result and also your legal challenge. I've enjoyed having you on. It's EnglishDemocrats.party to find out more about Robin's party. And you've done well. I'm speaking to you from Manchester. The party has done well here in the mayoral election up here. I know that. I know you've got a solid support in this neck of the woods. So all the best to you and your colleagues tomorrow. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, really good stuff. I'm actually speaking from Salford today, not from Manchester, Greater Manchester. One or two of you eagle-eyed listeners noticed that. You said, oh, Richie, I noticed you changed your Twitter profile. Salford, Greater Manchester. Yeah, the very interesting thing there is that legal challenge is ongoing and it seems to be appropriate. It seems to be on very, very solid legal ground, the notion that we did leave the European Union on March 29th, irrespective of what Theresa May and her cronies in Brussels say about delaying our departure until October 31st. The problem with all of this is, and I said this to my pal Cocobell, when has the law ever mattered to these people? That's the gist of it. When has the law ever mattered to these people? Right, before I go any further, plenty of tweets coming in. Hi to Natalie Stacey. Hi to Gail as well. Hi to Crispy G. Hi to Mad Monk, who says, I love that, Mad Monk. He says, Richie, could there be public funding to help in the court case? All those that voted for Brexit, if they give a pound or two towards the court case for Robin Tilbrook. Right, well, all I can say is, excuse me, there isn't any appeal, at least that I can see. But Robin's web or the party's website is EnglishDemocrats.party. That's www.EnglishDemocrats.party. And you can follow Robin Tilbrook on Twitter. It's at Robin Tilbrook. Surprise, surprise. That's where he is there. Nice fella. Very, very important. And again, you heard him say there, and he said to me, Richie, you know, he said to me off air, this is a fact. He said, we've got it on good authority that we're blocked from the BBC, we're barred. We're not allowed. We're not scheduled to be interviewed by any BBC reporter on any BBC channel about this particular legal challenge, because as he said, the BBC is overwhelmingly, as an institution, in favour of the UK staying in the European Union, which we will. We're not going anywhere. Said this years ago. 3 years ago, to be exact. Right. Now, it's being reported by Sky News' John Craig, amongst others, that Theresa May might resign this evening. Let me just have a look. Let me bring this up. Because the BBC are running a live rolling, what would you call it? A rolling blog. And a number of people are saying she's going to go. But now the 1922 committee have been told that she won't go. This is the backbench committee, the Conservative Party backbench committee. Tom Tugendhat has been speaking. This is the toxic Tory Tom Tugendhat. Spoke quite a bit about him in the past with respect to the Skripal poisoning that never happened, at least in my opinion anyway, in Salisbury. He's been speaking to the Beeb saying he supports Michael Gove for leader. I don't know. Friends of mine are saying they're going to have a punt with their bookmaker of choice, that Theresa May won't be in charge tomorrow morning. I might hold fire on that. Pippa Crerar has been tweeting. The political editor of the Daily Mirror, Pippa Crerar, has been tweeting that a senior number 10 source has told her that there will not be a statement from Theresa May this evening. That there won't be. Urgent meetings going on all over the place. Theresa May is finished, and it's probably going to happen before the end of business tomorrow, or maybe even Thursday, but it might not happen this evening. It might not happen this evening, right? Okay. So that's all. That's the latest on Theresa May there. So hold your horses there. Hold your horses. Friends of mine telling me, Jean-Anne Crowley, the great Jean-Anne Crowley, telling me that RTE completely belongs to the European Union. It always did, Jean-Anne. I've not had access really to much RTE output for a number of years, apart from the website. And it was always apparent that RTE, but to be fair, pretty much every broadcasting organisation in Ireland, including the commercials, have always been pretty much in favour of Ireland's membership of the European Union. Right. Now, I'm going to love you and leave you. I'd asked Gilad Atzmon to come on the programme, and I didn't hear from Gilad before I went to air. And then he got back to me and said, oh, I could have done it, Richie. So I said, look, this was during my interview with Robin. So Gilad's going to come on the programme tomorrow because he's written a fantastic article, which I'm going to tweet out in a few minutes, about Nigel Farage and his place in British politics now. And he's juxtaposed Farage's rise with Donald Trump. This is all about nostalgia. It's wonderful. It's very good. If you go to gilad.co.uk, I'm not doing the article great justice now, but gilad.co.uk, under the writings segment, you'll find his latest piece. It's really, really, really good about why people like Farage are coming to prominence now and why the left, as we used to know it, is falling away and it's in disarray and it's all over the place and it's kind of eating itself. Very good stuff from Gilad Atzmon. I've invited him to come on the programme to talk to me tomorrow about that, so Gilad will come on. This programme was due to be only an hour long, but I'm going to love you and leave you. I think it's gone okay. There are a few sound issues, but I will tidy those up with the help of the one and only Paul Ripley. Before I go, let me pay tribute to Paul Ripley, the impresario of Fab Radio, that can be heard at fabradiointernational.com. Paul Ripley is one of the nicest human beings that anybody could ever want to meet. A gentleman and a scholar. And when I came up to the UK, when I came up to Manchester from London after the demise of the People's Voice Television, and I arrived in Madchester around about early July to mid-July 2014. And the very first person I met when I came up here was Paul Ripley. The second person I met was Hayden Hewitt, but I'd met Hayden already at TPV. And Paul Ripley said to me, Richie, I understand that you're going to do a live radio show daily from a purpose-built studio. And I said, I am. And Paul Ripley said, I'll build you that studio, my friend, and I'll do it for the love of radio and for the love of independent radio. I don't want a sausage, nor do I want a bean from you, he said. And a friendship was born that I think will last forevermore. Wonderful man, Paul Ripley. Known in music circles in Manchester. Fantastic sound man and engineer. And he's kept FabRadioInternational.com going for a number of years now. And it's going from strength to strength because of his interest in it and because of his knowledge. He came out to Salford with me earlier this week and has built this wonderful studio, which is a tribute to him and a tribute to you, the listener, for supporting the programme, because it's through your support that we can do it. I think Roger put a picture on Facebook on the Richie Allen Show. It's fantastic. It is industry standard, with industry standard equipment, and that is why it sounds so absolutely beautiful when it's on air and live. Paul Ripley takes all the credit for it. One of the greatest guys I've ever had the privilege to meet. So thank you, Paul. Next week, the programme goes back to 2 hours every Monday to Thursday, with Sunday View on Sunday, with guests, of course. But as kind of finding my feet with the studio this particular week, it's a little bit shorter this week. You don't mind that. I'm going to love you and leave you. Look, if you go and vote in the European Union elections tomorrow, that's your business. I wouldn't think any less of you for it. I'm obviously not going to. Of course not. No, of course I'm not, for reasons given a million times on this particular show. So that's it, right. So Gilad will join me tomorrow. I might have another guest as well. That'll be Thursday's programme. This has been Wednesday's programme. I've been Richie Allen. It's been fantastic speaking with you. And it's great to be back. And it's lovely to be in a new place, in a new house, in a new neighbourhood, with lovely neighbours, must I say. I must say that as well. Wonderful people we've been getting to know. And I'm very close to my friend Tez. Let me give Tez a big shout out, because he helped with the move. He put his muscle, he put his elbows, he put his weight behind the move and helped me with a van and delivering stuff as well. Great guy, Tez. My friend Tez Howell, who's only around the corner from me now and will be very important to the programme going forward with monetising it. I'll tell you more about that anon as well. So thanks to Tez as well. And to Paul Ripley. Look after yourselves and one another. That's been Wednesday's Richie Allen Show, I think. It's great to be back. I love you for listening to this programme and for supporting it. Go to richieallen.co.uk to lend your support. See you tomorrow. This is Slow Hand.